Hello, this is Debbie back with the E edition for the Decatur Herald and Review on Wednesday, July 6th, 2016. Starting on the front page, of course, and first article popping up here by Ryan Voiles, a staff writer with them, is an article titled Customers Haven. Customers having an appetite for outdoor dining. Well, at any rate, Decatur. With Lake Decatur glistening in the background, Karen Schwartz can't think of many places better to share a cocktail with friends. As she and some friends enjoyed a weekend meal on the deck of the beach house, Schwartz said, the perfect dining experience goes beyond the food and drink. There's something about the ambiance of sitting out here, feeling a breeze and taking in the sight, she said. Tapping into this aspect of customer satisfaction has prompted more Decatur businesses to take advantage of the outdoors and put an emphasis on outdoor seating options. The businesses that provide the outdoor dining option include such places as Lock, Stock & Barrel and Donnie's Homespun Pizza near Millikan University to the aforementioned Beach House in Nelson Park and an increased number of restaurants in the downtown area. Beach House owner Todd Mason is reminded of the appeal of the option every day. We get phone calls every day. People are asking, can we sit outside? Can we sit out? He said. After last year's renovations to the restaurant's deck, the capacity for the outdoor dining of the Beach House is around 150, though it currently has chairs for just 60 patrons. Mason said outdoor dining accounts for about 30% of the restaurant's non-catering business. It's not a make-or-break aspect of the restaurant, especially with the area's cold winters and blistering hot summers. But Mason said the al fresco dining options are more important for the restaurant than just helping its bottom line. It's hard to put a value on it, Mason said. It's just something we feel is important for us, that is important for the community. You cannot go to Springfield, Bloomington, or other places nearby and get what you can experience here. That value to the community is something that city officials have spent several years emphasizing to restaurant owners. Whenever a restaurant in the area has the option of having outdoor dining, Patrick Hoban, Decatur's economic development officer, said it's something they encourage restaurants to explore. Aside from the potential increase in seating for customers, Hoban said the societal aspect is one that can have a positive aspect on the community. It's the total quality of life. Total quality of life issue, he said. It's one thing to be out and about eating inside, but when you're outside, it's just more of a social thing. The city's recent downtown streetscape enhancement project, included widened sidewalks that encourage restaurants to consider adding outdoor dining. One of the restaurants that took advantage of the widened sidewalks was Coney McCain's American Eatery, which added 14 seats outside its restaurant on East Prairie Avenue in 2010. Last year's renovations to the restaurant, which increased inside seating from 42 to 100, has lessened the fiscal importance of the outdoor seats, but owner Lee Stukens said for a time it helped add about 20% additional income for the restaurant. Stukens said outdoor seating is a hit whenever there's activities in Central Park, like the Decatur Municipal Band's weekly summer concerts. It's also something Stukens said adds some character and appeal to the downtown area. Whether or not people are even dining out there, it makes the downtown area look more inviting and pedestrian-friendly. The effort to add outdoor dining options goes beyond making the area more inviting to locals looking to chow down on a meal. Outdoor dining also could lead to businesses moving to the area or expanding their existing business. Ryan McCrady, president of the Economic Development Corporation of Decatur and Macon County, said that one of the major things discussed with potential employers looking to move to Decatur is quality of life. And one of the quality of life issues near the top of the list is having unique outdoor dining options. It may not seem like a big deal, but It really is, he said. The appeal of outdoor dining is really important for people. End of that article. Continuing down the front page, government and politics from AP Washington. No charges for Clinton, FBI says, despite biting criticism. The FBI lifted a major legal threat to Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign Tuesday, recommending no criminal charges for her handling of highly classified material in a private email account. But Director James Comey's scathing criticism of her extremely careless behavior revitalized Republican attacks and guaranteed the issue will continue to dog her. Comey's announcement effectively removed any possibility of criminal prosecution arising from Clinton's email practices as President Barack Obama's Secretary of State. Attorney General Loretta Lynch said last week that she intended to accept the recommendations of the FBI and of career prosecutors. But the FBI director's blistering televised statement excoriated her handling of national secrets, contradicted her past explanations about her emails, and ensured she will remain on the defensive about voters' views of her trustworthiness and judgment. GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump said the statement provided more evidence against, quote, crooked Hillary, unquote, and showed anew that the system is rigged. Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan said the decision not to prosecute simply defied explanation. The findings concluded a year-long FBI investigation into whether Clinton mishandled classified information, either intentionally or through gross negligence. Investigators who pored over tens of thousands of emails found no proof that Clinton or her aides intended to break laws governing the handling of classified information, Comey said. But he said, quote, there is evidence that they were extremely careless in their handling of very sensitive, highly classified information. The statement was extraordinary, with Comey revealing his recommendation on live television from FBI headquarters rather than privately to Justice Department prosecutors, as is normally the case. Comey said he shared the FBI's findings with no one before his announcement, which came just before Clinton traveled to North Carolina with Obama and Air Force One to campaign with him for the first time this year. The announcement came 3 days after the FBI interviewed Clinton in a final step of its year-long investigation. Comey directly contradicted many of Clinton's past explanations in the case, including her assertion that she turned over all her emails and that she never sent or received any that were classified at the time. The FBI chief said that in the course of the investigation, 113 emails were determined to contain classified information at the time they were sent or received. He also found that, quote, several thousand work-related emails, unquote, were not among the group of 30,000 Clinton turned over in 2014. And he raised the possibility that people hostile to the U.S. had gained access to her personal email account. There is evidence to support a conclusion that any reasonable person in Secretary Clinton's position should have known that an unclassified system was no place for sensitive conversations, Comey said. Yet after criticizing Clinton, her aides, and the State Department for their actions, he said that after looking at similar circumstances in past inquiries, the FBI believed that no reasonable prosecutor would bring such a case. No charges are appropriate in this case, said Comey, who began a 10-year term as FBI director in 2013, meaning he would presumably remain if she were elected president. The recommendation did not stop Trump, who has called for criminal charges, from continuing to make her private email server a campaign issue. After Comey's announcement, Trump tweeted, "The system's rigged. Very, very unfair. As usual, bad judgment." And House Speaker Ryan of Wisconsin said the decision defied explanation, adding, no one should be above the law. Clinton campaign spokesman Brian Fallon, meanwhile, voiced approval for the decision, but reiterated that it had been a mistake for Clinton to use personal email. Clinton's personal email server, which she relied on exclusively for government and personal business, has shadowed her campaign since the AP revealed its existence in March 2015. She had repeatedly said no email she sent or received was marked classified, but the Justice Department began investigating last summer following a referral from the Inspector General for the Intelligence Community. The scrutiny was compounded by a critical audit in May from the State Department's Inspector General, the agency's internal watchdog, that said Clinton and her team ignored clear warnings from department officials that her email setup violated federal standards and could leave sensitive material vulnerable to hackers. Clinton declined to talk to the Inspector General, but the audit said she had feared, quote, the personal being accessible, unquote, if she used a government email account. The Clinton campaign said the agents interviewed her last Saturday for 3.5 hours at FBI headquarters. Agents had earlier interviewed top aides, including her former State Department Chief of Staff, Cheryl Mills, and Huma Abedin, a longtime aide who is now the vice chairwoman of the Clinton's campaign. The staff member who set up the server, Brian Pagliano, was granted limited immunity from prosecution by the Justice Department and also agreed to speak with the prosecutors. Lynch said Friday she'd accept whatever findings and recommendations were presented to her. Though she had said she'd already settled on that process, her statement came days after an impromptu meeting with former President Bill Clinton on her airplane in Phoenix that she had acknowledged had led to questions about neutrality of the investigation. End of that article. Describe a picture here that's cute. Doesn't seem to have an article with it. Picture's done by Jim Bowling of Herald and Review, and it has two people. The man has Wild Heart across his t-shirt and has a frog hat on, a toad hat, whatever. It's very good, and a microphone. Jan and George Sergios lead children in songs about nature during their presentation Tuesday at Forsyth Public Library. It looks fun. End of that. Government and Politics Again by Allison Petty of the H&R. Jobs, Infrastructure, Neighborhoods, Top Council Concerns. Economic development, infrastructure, and neighborhoods rose to the top of the Decatur City Council's concerns during a discussion of future goals Tuesday. Everything is solved if we have jobs. Economic development is truly everything, Mayor Julie Moore Wolf said. I think we've made some great strides in basically laying the base for job creation, citing ongoing work to secure the city's water supply and fix sewers and roads. The conversation took place during a study session, part of the months-long process for council members to define and prioritize their target areas. Council members first offered ideas in January, and the city also collected input from residents who offered a wide variety of suggestions. City staff members are expected to use the council discussion Tuesday as guidance in developing a final document. Councilman Bill Faber said neighbors had asked him to deliver a message to his fellow council members. We don't have jobs. We don't have city. He suggested that city leaders, including Economic Development Officer Patrick Hoban, might have to start small. Every job that we grow this week, next week, next month is a win, he said. Several council members highlighted worries about the appearance and stability of Decatur neighborhoods. Councilwoman Dana Ray cited one of the comments submitted by a resident whose relative worked as a driver for one of the city's major employers. When drivers bring visitors to the city, they take a strategic route to avoid certain areas, the person said. Ray said she does the same thing when recruiting through her job. She also reflected on disparaging remarks made by a visiting friend, saying she hadn't realized how some people viewed the area from the outside. For that to be an impression for people who are in our community just for a small time period, I think that's something we really need to take more seriously, she said. Council members also spoke specifically about construction of an overpass at Interstate 72 for Martin Luther King Jr. Drive and an overpass at Brush College Road, as well as the need to maintain and possibly rebuild some of the city's 7 fire stations. But as they did so, the council members also repeatedly referenced the city's tight financial situation. We're trying to maintain a city that essentially we can no longer afford, Councilwoman Lisa Gregory said, citing the population loss in recent decades. The key to that really is jobs. Councilman Chris Funk reiterated that the population loss and its corresponding decline in revenues come at a time when costs for aging infrastructure and pensions are growing. The city needs to do more with less, he said, and cannot rely on revenue hikes such as the property tax, utility tax, and hotel tax increases that the council approved late last year. I said last year, we kind of had to take our medicine. We had to do what we had to do, but that can't be the solution this year. It can't be the solution for the next many years. We have to generate smarter fiscal solutions. In other business, the council unanimously approved changes to city code that outline rules for horse owners. Specifically, they are now required to have at least 1 acre of property per animal, to provide a stall for each animal, and to ensure the stall is at least 75 feet from other houses. Also, during the meeting, Faber revisited his proposal for a referendum on the November ballot that would change city code, requiring the council to approve the termination of any police or fire chiefs. Under Decatur's form of government and city code, City Manager Tim Gleason holds the power to hire and fire all city department heads. Faber said the firing in February of former Decatur Police Chief Brad Sweeney wounded the spirit of our people. Sweeney subsequently sued the city. This lawsuit was dismissed by a Macon County judge, a decision the former chief is appealing to a higher court. I speak this evening to let the citizens of the city know that I hear their voices of anger and frustration, Faber said. The people ask for leadership and explanation. Instead, the people watch their elected leaders turn away as if nothing happened. Faber needed the support of two other council members in order to place the item on the agenda, Moore Wolf said. When she asked if anyone wanted to support the measure, the other council members did not speak. End of that article. And the last article on the first page of the July 6th Decatur Herald and Review E edition is Gabby's Law Awaits Signature. Bill Requiring Sepsis Protocols Awaits Rauner's Signature. This is by Dan Petrella, the Springfield Bureau Chief for the Herald and Review. Springfield. Tony Galbo of Monticello hopes that a bill currently sitting on Governor Bruce Rauner's desk spares other families from the kind of pain he and his wife Liz have gone through since losing their daughter Gabby just over 4 years ago. 5-year-old Gabby died May 11, 2012 at the Children's Hospital of Illinois at OSF St. Francis Medical Center in Peoria. She died of septic shock resulting from a case of Rocky Mountain spotted fever, a tick-borne disease that went undiagnosed and untreated by doctors at Carle Foundation Hospital in Urbana. Dubbed Gabby's Law, the bill would require every hospital in Illinois to develop, quote, evidence-based protocols, unquote, for the early detection and treatment of patients with sepsis, severe sepsis, or septic shock. Galbo called the legislation a huge supportive measure. It's going to stop somebody else from having to do what we're doing, he said. Sepsis is, quote, the body's overwhelming and life-threatening response to an infection which can lead to tissue damage, organ failure, and death, unquote, according to the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Well, sepsis can result from any infection. Young children, the elderly, and people with weakened immune systems are especially susceptible, according to the CDC. Sepsis kills more than 258,000 people in the U.S. each year, making it its ninth leading cause of disease-related deaths. Senator Chapin Rose, Republican Democrat, sponsored Gabby's Law, which was approved unanimously this spring in both chambers of the General Assembly. Rauner's office said the legislation, which was sent to him June 22nd, is under review. It's frankly amazing how little known this is, and yet it takes so many lives in our year, Rose said, noting that sepsis accounts for more deaths each year than prostate cancer, breast cancer, and AIDS combined. Well, federal law already requires many hospitals to have sepsis protocols in place. The new Illinois law would make it mandatory for every hospital in the state. Rose said the bill should increase awareness among medical professionals and the general public. Obviously, we wish that this tragedy had never occurred, but this bill is going to save somebody's life, he said, adding, quote, time is your enemy. Early detection is just absolutely imperative, unquote. In addition to working with the Galbo family, Rose collaborated with the Illinois Hospital Association in developing the legislation. Danny Chun, a spokesman for the association, said if it becomes law, the proposal will increase patient safety at hospitals statewide. Sepsis is an ongoing challenge in the healthcare world, Chun said. This is an important step. For the Galbos, it's just the first step. Tony Galbor said their next goal is to get a parents' bill of rights approved in Illinois. Among other changes, they'd like to see a requirement that doctors review lab results with patients, with parents or caregivers before children are discharged from hospitals. Had that happened to Carl, he said, they may have caught red flags in Gabby's result before it was too late. The family in the hospital reached an out-of-court settlement earlier this year. End of that article, end of the front page. We'll continue here. On A2, there are some announcements of things happening today, and we'll go through some of them that are still on as I read this. Midnight Express, 7 p.m., Playmore Dance Land. Arcola Fireworks are at 9 o'clock tonight in Moore Park. Ferris Bueller's Day Off is at the Lincoln Square Theater tonight at 8. Family Friday, 9:30 to 7 at the Children's Museum of Illinois in Decatur. Reds, Whites, and Blues is tonight, 6 to 9 at Allerton Park. There are a bunch of exhibits and music. Tonight at 7 p.m., Bement Country Opry in Monticello, Samantha Baker Kepton. And on stage, the Little Theater on the Square in Sullivan, Chicago. And then also sometimes, I guess this is, go back and forth with Chicago, How I Became a Pirate, 10:30 a.m. So that must be the kids show. And then the evening show is Chicago at 8 o'clock. So that is the end of those announcements. A3 brings us local. Trial ordered related to killing. Pair to face trial related to fatal shooting. This is by Dave Fope, a Lee News Service writer out of Charleston. Two men took part in an attempt to retrieve stolen guns that ultimately led to the shooting death of a woman in Mattoon last month. That's what testimony indicated Tuesday when a judge ordered two of four men charged in connection with the shooting to stand trial on conspiracy and attempted armed robbery charges. Matthew S. Cook and Kevin W. Johnson both pleaded not guilty to the charges that accused them of a role in a confrontation resulting in the shooting that led to the death of Sierra J. Fares on June 18th. Police testimony Tuesday indicated that Cook and Johnson accompanied Sean D. Adamson to the apartment at 313 South 21st Street where Adamson and James Todd Schaefer fired shots during the confrontation. Fares was hit by one of the shots, and 23-year-old Charleston woman later died at Sarah Bush Lincoln Health Center. Cook, 31, and Johnson, 38, aren't accused of firing guns during that incident. However, on Tuesday, Mattoon Police Lieutenant Sam Gaines testified that Schaefer was able to identify Cook as one of the people he saw outside the apartment just before the shooting took place. Schaefer and Fares were at the apartment, the residence of a friend, and she left following an argument but was outside during the shooting, Gaines related. According to Johnson, Adamson fired once at the apartment, leading Schaefer to return fire through the door while he was inside, he added. Gaines said several people interviewed said Adamson indicated he wanted to confront Schaefer about stealing guns from him. Johnson also admitted going to the residence at Adamson's request, he also said. Each of the suspect's attorneys tried to convince Coles County Circuit Judge Teresa Ryder that Gaines' account wasn't enough to tie the suspects to a criminal offense. Teresa Matthews, Johnson's attorney, argued that the evidence showed only that Johnson went to the residence at Adamson's request, but didn't indicate that he went there with an intent to commit a robbery. Attorney Dwayne Peters, who represents Cook, contended there was nothing to show Cook was accountable for what happened, and there was no indication of a demand for property to mean a robbery attempt. In response, State's Attorney Brian Bauer said the three men were acting in concert to try to get the guns back Adamson claimed were stolen. Their course of conduct started earlier as the accounts of people hearing of Adamson's plans for the confrontation confirmed, he said. Cook and Johnson remained in jail with bond for set breach set at a level that would require $10,000 to be posted for release. Adamson, 33, made his first court appearance Tuesday and was scheduled for a Thursday hearing on the matter of his attorney. Schaefer, 24, is scheduled for a hearing on Monday. Adamson and Schaefer are both charged with first-degree murder and are jailed with bond for each at $200,000. Adamson is accused of causing Fair's death by starting the confrontation that led to the shooting. Schaefer allegedly fired the gun intending to kill Fair's or another person, or that he knew that a death was possible. End of that article. In education, young readers hear the call of the wild. Oh, I guess that's what the picture went with. Forsyth, and this is by Chris Lusvardi, one of the staff writers for H&R. Allie Russell of Decatur wanted to capture what turned into a special moment Tuesday for her 4-year-old daughter, Sophia, during a program at the Forsyth Public Library. Russell took a cell phone photo while Sophia was playing Wolf as part of the Wild Heart musical group performance. Russell said it was the first time her daughter had been on a stage in front of an audience, so Sophia was eager to watch the video afterwards. Being able to create memories like that while getting excited about learning is exactly why Russell said they've been attending some of the weekly programs at the library. We read all the time, Russell said. These are fun, family-friendly activities. It's a great age for her to get started on her own and really enjoy them. Using their interest in forestry and environmental science, George and Jan Sergios of META, Missouri, led the children through Nature's Olympics while singing about outstanding animal athletes such as frogs and toads. Children of all ages, including those attending daycare in the Decatur Park District Summer Day Camp, could take turns being part of the performance. Being outside is part of our family, and we love music, Jan Sergios said. We want to pass on a conservation message to children, to kids, in a creative way. Their 16-year-old daughter, Sophia, has been helping with the music as she's been growing up, Jan Sergios said. The program was part of what's turning into a busy summer full of activities at the library, said Sandy Hayes, Youth Services librarian. About 700 people are signed up for the summer reading program. The weekly programs on Tuesday afternoons have been well attended, with a bubble show, magic show, juggler, and Wizard of Oz marionettes in June, Hayes said. Upcoming activities include author Eddie Price talking July 12th about Little Miss Grubby Toes and her misadventure with bees, the Fred and His Feathered Friends program July 19th about rescued birds, and a celebration July 26th with ice cream to conclude the summer. The programs are scheduled from 2 to 3 p.m. on Tuesday afternoons. More information about the summer library program is available at the library, and either on their website or their phone number, 877-8174, 877-8174. We have some great entertainment, Hayes said. This community really supports the library. We try to bring in a variety of fun groups. Hayes said the programs help to bring in children and keep them interested in reading while being out of school. End of that article. And that ends part one of the Wednesday, July 6, 2016. Oh, I forgot to say, this was Debbie talking. You probably know that. It's Wednesday. And I'll be back with part two shortly.